This is the evening program with Peter Gerz.
Peter Gerz.
Dr. Bernard Casey, did you say Bernard? Bernard, I beg your pardon. Dr. Bernard Casey, visiting fellow in Hellenic Observatory School of Economics, London, has been here at Flinders University and other Australian universities visiting as a research fellow. Welcome, Bernard. Thank you for coming in.
It is an interesting opportunity.
You're a social economist.
I work on the economics of ageing societies, and so I work in a part of London School of Economics normally, which is related to personal social services, long-term care, and issues like that. But I've done work on the economics of ageing societies over most of my professional life and have aged gracefully as I did so.
You saw it coming.
I was doing age and employment when most people in Europe were studying youth unemployment.
Yes. How did you see this coming? It's interesting.
It was fortuitous. I actually landed up in Germany at the very end of the 1970s, and I was working in a government research institute, and Germany was interested in issues of older worker unemployment because they had a wonderful apprenticeship system in Germany, and therefore they didn't worry about youth unemployment like almost everybody else was. In fact, they had older people to worry about. So I was involved in a research project with respect to that in 1980-1981, and it kind of stuck with me for the rest of my life. And as I moved from looking at age and employment to looking at early retirement, then the financing of pensions, then I got on to looking at the financing of long-term care for the frail elderly. Now, you must understand that as my reference group was going up, I was aging gradually with it.
Yeah.
I thought when I got to the stage of doing long-term care of the frail elderly, there wasn't much else to do. I possibly needed only to do the economics of death. And then I could retire gracefully. But somebody came to me and said to me, "Ah, no, Bernard, there is the economics of the afterlife." So I've still got all of that in front of me.
I met the other week an academic who is a space archaeologist.
I heard you talking to her.
She was extraordinary. Because you think, you know, when you first hear this, you don't sort of stop and think. And the more we discussed it, the more fascinating it was. Anyway, so you're a social economist like Marx.
No, not a socialist economist. I studied the economics of social.
But he was a social economist.
Sometimes he was. He was more of a sort of macro, and he was sometimes a labour. He was a lot of things.
Yes, he was.
We could be proud to be as much as he was, but it's very difficult to be a global person like that these days. Everything's much more fragmented.
Yes. Why Greece?
That's a sort of slightly odd and separate thing. I have been doing work on European social policy over many years. In the end of the 90s, beginning of the 2000s, I met in Berlin somebody from Greece who was preparing Greece for the Greek presidency of the European Union. And when in those days you had presidencies, you had subjects with which you were concerned, and they wanted to mount quite a big exercise on social policy, and I was pulled into that as a contributor. The person who I was pulled into work with, and I've kept in contact and I've been working with him ever since, he and I subsequently got involved in advice to the government of Cyprus when Cyprus joined the European Union. So we then did quite a lot of work together with Cyprus. He comes from Greece, this person. And then I joined. Well, what happened was that the crisis of the Eurozone hit Europe, and it hit Greece in the first instance. So if you wanted to study economic crises, studying Greece was rather interesting. So I got involved in a number of seminars and discussions at LSE about that. And then I suggested to them, well, actually, look, if you call yourself an Hellenic observatory, you ought to be interested in a little bit more than the Greek mainland. Cyprus is also sort of Hellenic, and I know something about Cyprus. So I joined up with them.
It's sort of Hellenic because it was Scottish at one point. It was owned by James II of Scotland, wasn't it?
It was owned by just about every empire
it's been
of
the
history.
Good time it's had been, by all.
Richard Coeur de Lion, he had it for a brief
while. The Phoenicians
had it. Everybody's had it. The Ottoman Turks had it. It's a very interesting place. You can only understand Cyprus, I think, if you can understand the Byzantine Empire.
Yes.
Now, if I told you that in my spare time, because doing social economics is... Economics is always described as the dismal science. Social security economics is the dismal branch of the social sciences. Yeah. So you need a bit of light relief. So my light relief is studying the history of late antiquity with particular reference to theological debates in Constantinople in the 4th and 5th century. But if you understand the Byzantine Empire, you can understand Cyprus, you get a solution.
And the Nicene Creed.
The Nicene Creed is one of the things which I sort of fiddle around with in my spare time. I worry about... It's an interesting story I could tell you. This is about a couple of bishops from... the centre of what is now Turkey, who landed up in Constantinople for a conference and for their work. And one of them wrote back to his friends back home and said, really, you know, it's almost impossible to get any decent service in the bathhouses here because the servants in the bathhouses, instead of doing their normal jobs and attending to you, are far too busy discussing the divinity of Christ. It was a very interesting time.
Say Constantinople and not Istanbul.
Did you know that Constantinople and Istanbul are actually exactly the same thing?
Of course.
I mean, in terms of words, Constantinople was always called not Constantinople, which is far too long. They used to refer to it as the polis.
And Istanbul is, which has always been there.
Pul in Istanbul is the polis, the city.
Dr. Bernard Casey, visiting research fellow here, Greece. What is the problem and what's the answer? There's a big topic.
Well, a good thing is that possibly Greece should never have been a part of a European monetary system, but it was difficult not to
because
let it be
small
so.
Population.
No, because it was a relatively underdeveloped country. It was nothing like most of the existing countries who joined when Greece was relatively early. It wasn't the first joiner, but it was one of the first rounds of joiners. It came in 1981.
And it has been troubled for three millennia.
It had been troubled for three millennia. It has a political system which is not exactly encouraging for good economic performance. But the problem was not only the Greeks. The problem was also, which I like to say, the European political elites who couldn't keep Greece as the cradle of democracy out of a system. They couldn't keep it out of the political system and they couldn't keep it out of the economic system either. It would have been unacceptable to do that. They had a mission which was a wider and deeper Europe in which everybody should participate, which would bring growth, and it would bring growth to everybody by participation.
Greece had been hampered too by the British Empire, essentially, in the 19th century when the British decided with romantic notions of Greece that, you know, with people like Byron and said it must have a royal family and gave it a royal house made up of Danes, Germans, Russians and English.
We were passing out royal houses around Europe with relations.
But that was one of the strangest ones. And, you know, then the Greeks wanted it, they didn't want it, they wanted it, they didn't want it, they wanted it, they didn't want it, and it came and went, came and went, came and went. The only thing that Greeks are now currently united on is they don't want it back, thank you.
They don't want that back. They also want to stay in Europe. And in general, they probably want to have the euro as a sign of respectability. But, I mean, what is interesting is that in 2004, when a whole lot of additional countries came and joined, there was material that was put out showing what a good thing this was, which showed that countries who had joined were converging. And converging meant growing, and they were getting closer up to the standards of living of the average of Europe and above that. Even at that time, when those lines were produced, and they did go up for a lot of countries, the line for Greece was always rather flat. So that was one problem. In 2008, and this is another issue, there was a study which was produced called 10 Years of the Euro by the European Central Bank. And 10 Years of the Euro, it was again a propagandistic exercise, you could say, and it showed what a jolly good thing this had been. But buried within it, there were a couple of footnotes which said there are some signs of imbalances with which we perhaps should be concerned. Now, everybody knew that there were signs of imbalance. Everybody knew by that stage and for a long time that Greece had been cooking its figures. I'd worked at the OECD at one stage. People came back from missions to Greece and would tell stories about it. The European Commission knew this.
How long can it be saved?
Well, I don't know whether it's a question of saving Greece or whether it's a question of saving the euro system and saving whatever.
But we saw in Greece the very peculiar situation whereby the Greek population voted in huge numbers in a referendum. And then a week later, the opposite was done to them, which seemed kind of strange and useless.
Well, it is strange. They want to be part of Europe. I don't think that very many of them want to go back to the drachma. They are sort of very worried about that. But they are in a very difficult position because they are very definitely in the category of losers of the Eurozone system in exactly the same way that Germany is a big winner of the system.
When will the Union dissolve? And when will who'll go first?
Britain? I don't think it will dissolve. I think it's most unlikely that Greece will be forced out. I don't think that Merkel could afford to be the chancellor who goes down as the chancellor who presided over even the beginning of a disintegration or something which might threaten a disintegration. Yes. She followed, I mean, her predecessor was Kohl. Kohl goes down in history as the chancellor of unity. And everybody remembers Kohl for that, if nothing else. Mm. She will not want to be remembered for something negative, so she won't dare to. But also,
she's a tough cookie.
Oh, she's a very interesting person. She is referred to as the master of nebulousness. Nobody quite knows what she's thinking. She is the master of dithering, of procrastination. She's very good at not being clear what she really wants. She's very interesting because she, on the one hand, allowed Draghi to be appointed to the head of the European Central Bank. And people were horrified. This southerner, these Italians are profligate, we can't possibly have him. But she puts in, as a counterweight, Weidemann from the Bundesbank onto the board. And so she's got two people looking after it.
Greece, and there's lessons here in Australia, but Greece is a much more extreme case. My guest, Dr. Bernard Casey, we're talking about Greece and the EU, of the diaspora. Populations, of course, have left in the mass immigration to this country, particularly after the Second World War. But the young are leaving Greece in droves because they can, to go and work in other European countries, leaving an ageing population propped up by social security, and there just ain't the money. And I think corruption within that social security system, alarmingly actually, there just ain't the money.
Yeah, I don't think the system is not as corrupt as people like to claim. I mean, one of the things which is said is that Greeks get very high pensions. Actually, some people get very high pensions as a proportion of a very low wage. The proportion of Greeks and the level of the average pension of Greece is putting a lot of people very close or even below Greek poverty standards. Another thing, and this comes back to a discussion of how Greece is perceived, the Greeks are perceived as somehow lazy and having a tendency to retire early. Certainly in Germany, it is talked about the wonderful dreadful early retirement opportunities of the Greek. If you actually look not at what the law in Greece permits some people. If you've been a mother who's had lots of children and you worked in the public service and something like that, you can get very early retirement. But and the Germans will compare that number with what the Germans are supposed to do in about 2026, when everybody will be supposed to retire at the age of 67. So they will compare things like 53 with 67. But if you look at the average age of retirement between Germany and Greece, it is almost identical.
There will be stresses on pensions, won't there?
Yes.
And it's going to be... because it's my ambition to get the pension.
It should you be your ambition to be actively aging and keeping going. That's what you should be
and
doing.
And
I'm sure you're
pension.
Quite happy doing so, and so am I.
And to get the pension. But I mean, we are an ageing population in the Western world.
Yeah.
When two of my grandparents were 80 in the mid-1970s, it was quite astonishing. I mean, few people were 80. Mm. It was really something to be 80.
Yeah.
And now every second person's 80.
Oh, yes. I mean, there is a remarkable increase in life expectancy at, you know, sort of normal pension ages, which has occurred over the last 20 years. My question is, will that be sustained? A lot of people say it's sort of going to go up exponentially. But there are a lot of people who actually say maybe this was actually a one-off event. And I kind of keep going around looking for... indicators that maybe that rise is flattening off. And there could be even be indicators that it could actually tip downwards. If you think about a lot of diseases, non-communicable diseases, which are affecting young people today, and I'm thinking of things like type 2 diabetes, obesity... Those young people, the fastest growing group of obese people, they're going to be tomorrow's older workers, and they're going to be the people who tomorrow might well not be able to work to these new higher retirement ages. So I don't think it's as clear cut, and I think there's a lot more things which people ought to be worrying about than merely the costs of pensions today. I think we ought to be worried deeply about the costs of long-term care of the frail elderly, and that's one of the things I'm working with people at Flinders, at Nils at the moment. It's something which I'm working on at London School of Economics still, because this seems to be actually an even bigger challenge. I used to work at the OECD in the early 2000s, and we were making projections of fiscal expenditures of ageing societies. We worked out, or at least we thought we worked out, what pension costs were going to be in the future. We could do that with some degree of precision because we knew how many old people there were going to be, and we knew how pension systems worked. We had next to no clue of what the costs of long-term care was. We didn't know who was providing it, we didn't know how it was financed, we didn't know how many people needed it. But I have done a number of calculations which actually suggest that in terms of rates of growth over the next 30, 40, 50 years, and that applies to Australia, and you can see this even in the intergenerational report which the government here produced recently, that actually pensions expenditure won't be going up very fast over the next, or very much over the next 30, 40 years. But care expenditure is going up really fast. Now, if some of the problems which I've been talking about into the bargain about morbidity in older age and later life start coming through, then I think we've got really big problems. I think we've got to address that. And it's something we know very little about at the moment. It's something which is chronically misunderstood. And one of the things I'm trying to do with the people in Flinders, and which I'm doing at London School of Economics, and which I'm doing for the European Commission in the next 3 years of my life as I age a little bit more and I start getting up to one of these ages, is actually that.
Dr. Bernard Casey, thank you very much. It's extraordinary to meet you. What is your accent? I can't quite place it.
That is an interesting question. I think I get it. I've put it down to getting it from my mother. My mother was... It has nothing to do with where my mother was brought up, not at all. But my mother was a school teacher, and my mother was slightly didactic and had a tendency to emphasise things. And I sort of picked this up, and I do it even more.
Well, it's a very pleasant idiosyncrasy. Thank you,
you.
Doctor, and all the best to you.
This is the evening programme.
Funny,
incisive,
and entertaining radio.
Peter Gers, here on ABC Local Radio.